Looking beyond the man, Donald Trump, to the entire Trumpocalypse.
And so this is the great danger, and really in many senses the Trumpocalypse, is that even if Donald Trump is removed from office, if people vote him out, even if he's impeached, whatever, the imprint that he has placed on our budgeting, on the focus of the federal government, could well continue long beyond him. And that means that long after Donald Trump is headed back to some tower in New York, we might really be suffering domestically and in many other senses because of his presidency. And that's why I suggest that it's so important to look beyond Donald Trump, look beyond him as a person, and look at the presidency as a whole. Look at the people who have power, what their agendas are, what agendas they're actually currently implementing, and to ask ourselves whether this is what we want.
That's John Nichols. We talk with him about his book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. We also talk with Valerie Brown, co-author of a just-released report for the magazine In These Times, about how the EPA has been in the pocket of Monsanto, to the detriment of our health, for over 40 years. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. My guest John Nichols says Donald Trump has assembled a rogues gallery of alt-right hate mongers, crony capitalists, immigrant bashers, and climate change deniers to run the American government. People like Betsy DeVos, Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, Stephen Miller, and the rest of the president's cabinet and appointments are a wrecking crew, Nichols says, that Trump has unleashed on the very institutions that are supposed to defend the interests of the American people. His book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, is a highly readable compendium of skullduggery, conflicts of interest, and ideological extremism that threaten to take America back to the worst abuses of the Gilded Age. John Nichols is the national affairs writer for The Nation magazine and a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He's also a co-founder of the media reform group Free Press. Well, John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So this book, very aptly named Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Now, you make a distinction between Donald Trump the man and Donald Trump the presidency. Draw out this distinction for us.
Sure. It's a great question to start on because I think that we have so personalized the presidency in the way that media covers it, and frankly in the way that most of us talk about it, that we often lose sight of the fact that when someone becomes president of the United States, they essentially become the leader of a very, very large organization with many, many arms to it, many, many components. And if we only obsess about, talk about, think about the individual who is sworn in on January 20th and serves 4 years in most circumstances, we lose sight of the fact that around that individual is a massive operation that extends from him, or maybe someday in the future from her, but that is often little noted. I'll give you an example. When George Washington was president of the United States more than 200 years ago, he had four cabinet members, five if you included his vice president. We knew them so well that we still to this day make Broadway plays about them. But today, I would venture to say that the overwhelming majority of Americans, dare I say 99%, could not name the whole cabinet, couldn't possibly begin to name the heads of all the regulatory agencies. And then beyond that, the members of the FCC, the SEC, the National Labor Relations Board, you run through all these incredibly powerful entities. And so what I want to emphasize to people is they should think about a presidency as something that's much bigger than the individual and that really has to be examined in a much more expansive way. The great danger is that we just
And yet, even though he surrounds himself, this is a presidency, not just a president, there is something about the American presidency that seems to be more and more like a king, like a monarch, the imperial presidency. Isn't that true?
That is totally true. And in fact, one of the things I write about in the book is the growth of the presidency over the last 200-some years. I'm not the first to say this by any means. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., decades ago, wrote a book called The Imperial Presidency. And it was a really important book because it suggested, coming from someone who had worked in the White House, who had written about the American presidency, that something fundamental had changed, that the image of the presidency as a part of a federal government with separated powers and checks and balances really had to be rethought. And what I think Schlesinger meant by that, and certainly what I mean by that, is that once upon a time you could think of the presidency as, you know, someone's elected, they come into power, and, you know, they really do set the tone for things. Now, because there's so much power that extends from the presidency, it's more than just an individual, and it's also, in many cases, quite permanent. To give you an example, of course, presidents appoint Supreme Court justices, and those justices serve beyond the presidency. But in fact, presidents appoint many people who serve terms that last longer than a presidency, or whose terms cross over from one presidency to the next. And so there really is a power that goes with the office that is definitional in a structural sense, i.e. that the person who holds the office can appoint people that have power going into the future, but that is also definitional in the, you know, in any kind of long-term structural and emotional, psychological, political, economic sense, i.e. presidents define us long after they have left. And so, again, it's this effort to suggest that the presidency is no longer, you know, a small office or an office where we have transfer power from one individual to the next. It's something much bigger. And then one final component of that, which I think is really important, is that tragically, while the judiciary has stepped up and its authority in some senses is greater, the legislative branch, which the founders clearly intended to have, you know, sort of a more powerful role in governance, has diminished. The legislative branch has the power to remove the president and the president's appointees. The president and his appointees do not have the power to remove the legislative branch. So it's clear the founders intended for the legislative branch to have a first among equals position. And yet, today, I don't think anyone would suggest that is the case. It's quite clear that presidents tend to dominate the legislative branch, or at the very least, the role that the legislative branch plays is as a backstop, if you will, a something that might slow a presidency down. But it's been a very, very long time since you could say that the country is being guided out of the Capitol rather than out of the White House.
You know, I found it interesting. You call the people around Trump the wrecking crew, which was exactly the way I started referring to them when it became really clear that his cabinet appointments were all about destroying the agencies at which they were put, you know, of which they were put the head of. And I have to just quote you saying, they are gross incompetents and stupefied partisans, dirty dealers and self-absorbed schemers, cruel executioners of inhumane policies, and the defenders of the indefensible. Now, you have some rough categories in dealing with Trump's circle: ideological messengers, political hacks, military-industrial complex generals and dollar diplomats, and privateers and corporatists. And you start with one of the latter, one of the privateers and corporatists, and that's Betsy DeVos. Why is she emblematic? Why do you start the book with her, John Nichols?
Well, that's a very good question. In many ways, Betsy DeVos frames the book. I start with her. There's also a more extensive chapter on her deeper into the book because I think she is emblematic. She is someone who would never have held this position in a previous Republican administration. Forget about written a well-regarded book about education, has never taught education in a major university. She has really avoided public schools through her own life and through, you know, as a parent. That's not where she's put her energy. In fact, she's put her energy as an incredibly wealthy person into undermining public schools, into taking resources away from them, structurally weakening them for purely political purposes. So she's not an educator. She's a political player. And it happens she's a powerful political player because she's rich. The tragedy of Betsy DeVos is that even though she's become powerful and influential in the area of education, she's never bothered to learn much about it. And that was brought out in her confirmation hearing, which in many senses was the most tragic of the many awful confirmation hearings. The Senate, by and large, did not do a good job. There were moments where individual senators really stepped up and did ask the right questions. But by and large, these people went through their confirmation process with a kind of a gentle prodding, a gentle challenging that was followed up by a confirmation vote organized by Mitch McConnell. In the case of Betsy DeVos, it really became evident during her confirmation hearing that she was not prepared for the job. There was a moment where Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire was questioning her about some basic education programs that serve children with special needs. These are long-term, well-established programs. Anybody who's been around the schools has an understanding of them. And it was clear to Maggie Hassan in the midst of the questioning that Betsy DeVos didn't know whether these were federal or state programs. She was literally stumbling on, you know, where they belonged. Hassan interrupted her and said, you know, you do understand that these are federal programs, right? Or you understand how they fit into the thing. And DeVos, at that point, you know, was kind of bumbling through it and saying, oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. And you saw a person who really had been put into a position where she was guaranteed to stumble. It was going to happen. In this case, it happened very embarrassingly with major programs involving people who are, in many cases, some of our most vulnerable students. But then it got even worse later in the hearing, where Bernie Sanders began to question DeVos and asked her, in a relatively gentle way, whether she thought that she would be sitting before the committee as a nominee to serve in the most important education post in the country if she and her family had not given more than $200 million to Republican candidates for public office. And DeVos, amazingly enough, did not say, well, of course I'd be sitting here, right? No question about it. I'm an expert in education. I've got all this background. I know what I'm doing. No, she said, well, you know, I think probably, maybe. I mean, she couldn't even muster a defense for herself. And to me, that sums up so much of the administration around Donald Trump. And what's tragic is that though Betsy DeVos did not have the skills to do the job, doesn't have the background to do the job, can't even make for a case for herself to be in the position, she's got all the power. You know, once she's confirmed by the Senate, she's running that incredibly powerful, incredibly important department, as are these other appointees. And because Donald Trump is unable to focus on anything for more than a few minutes, there's very little evidence that he's paying attention to what she's doing. And so you end up with this terrible situation where somebody who shouldn't be in the position assumes it and takes all the power because the president isn't all that interested in it. And there's not much congressional oversight. And in my mind, that's why we have to pay attention to these people, because they are governing in our name, but in large part without our informed consent, and often without much scrutiny.
You know, it does seem to me as if many of these appointees have, that they really come out of the Republican Party itself as a whole, not necessarily out of Trump. Some of them do, out of Trump's campaign, of course they do. But, you know, as you say, he's not all that interested in governing. He may be interested in building his brand more than anything else. And so he's leaving the governing up to people who have been very part and parcel of the Republican Party So, in a way, the legislature has had a great impact.
Well, it's good. It's an interesting point to make. Here's what I'd suggest. The people that are in many of these positions are long-term Republican players. But generally, they were on the fringe of the Republican Party. They weren't in the mainstream as regards the areas where they've come to power. The Republican Party has transformed over the last 20 years. And, you could argue over the last 10 years, the Republican Party, as it existed when George W. Bush was president of the United States, is very, very different from this Republican Party. Now, certainly when Bush was president, I was a sharp critic of his handling of almost every issue, and an even sharper critic of Dick Cheney. I certainly wasn't a fan of what Republicans in Congress were doing. But to compare the Republican Party of, say, 2005 to the Republican Party of today, it would be comic. What's happened over the last, 10 years, is that the party has moved radically to the right. It has embraced its extremes. The person largely responsible for this was Reince Priebus. As chairman of the RNC, in the difficult aftermath of the 2012 election, when the Republican Party had been quite certain that it was going to remove Barack Obama from office, but in fact, not only didn't remove him, but fell back in a lot of its positions of strength. It was weakened, and the party recognized that it had a problem. Priebus tried, in the immediate aftermath of that election, to argue for expanding the focus of the party, for trying to reach out to women, people of color, young people, the LGBTQ community, and they had a big report on how they ought to do some of this. It wasn't that the Republican Party was going to become a liberal party, but it was going to become a little bit more mainstream than it was in 2012. Instead of making that his mission, as party chairs in the past have, remember in the 1950s, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee took an incredibly courageous stand and literally said, this party has to stand for civil rights. And so there have been many cases over the years where party leaders have recognized a problem and worked over many years to address it. Priebus put this report out. And then when the party did well in the 2014 election cycle, he pretty much tossed it aside. And as Donald Trump rose from the far fringe of the party into its mainstream, instead of resisting that and trying to assure that the party continues on a trajectory toward trying to reach the great mass of Americans, Priebus embraced a hard lurch to the right. And he and Paul Ryan legitimized this extreme lurch to the right. And so as a result, they sort of threw the door open to a number of people who would never have served in previous Republican administrations. Betsy DeVos is, of course, an example of that, but so too is Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt, as the Attorney General of Oklahoma, he kind of waged open war on mainstream environmental thinking, particularly as regards climate change. He's way to the right of where most Republicans have been. So as a result, this guy who certainly George W. Bush would never have put in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency is now in charge of it. And I can run through position after position at Health and Human Services. Tom Price has now stepped down. But Tom Price was one of the most extreme people in the House of Representatives. The head of Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, this is a guy who was in a tiny minority of extremists favoring government shutdowns within the Republican caucus in 2014 and 2015. And so you understand that, yes, these people identify as Republicans, but these people are the folks that Republicans used to kind of put in the back row or push to the side. Now they are running the most powerful government agencies, in some cases in the world, literally agencies that have tens of thousands of employees, billions of dollars in budgeting, and very, very definitional roles in the areas that, for which they've been given responsibility.
Yeah, talk about Ryan Zinke, for example, Interior Secretary, who, was really, as Secretary of Interior, is charged with protecting America's public lands. What are his plans for America's public lands?
It's the fascinating thing with Ryan Zinke. He presented himself as a, sort of a Roosevelt Republican, i.e. Teddy Roosevelt Republican, a conservative guy who really loved the land, who really cared about parks and public property and nature and things like that. But he couldn't be anything further from that. The fact of the matter is that as a member of the House, Ryan Zinke entertained some of the most radical proposals for undermining public control of lands which we, the people of the United States, own. He has been very much in the pocket of corporate interests, developer interests, for a very, very long time. He's also an incredibly extreme guy. His statements at the Republican National Convention were some of the most visceral statements of the whole convention as regards Hillary Clinton and as regards the Democrats. And so the thing to understand about Ryan Zinke is he knew enough to present himself at during his confirmation hearings and in some early interviews as a relatively moderate figure. But what we have seen since he's taken office, and I read a lot about this in the book because I think he's one of the more interesting characters, what we've seen since he's taken office is a meticulous and systematic effort to undermine public control of public lands, to loosen things up for developers, to loosen things up for even mineral extraction. And the fact of the matter is, if Ryan Zinke continues on the trajectory he is on, and if he finishes out his tenure, you know, at least the 4 years in this position, there is simply no question that the public lands of the United States will be less well protected, and in many cases, they will be literally exploited because of an appointment by Donald Trump of somebody who, you know, you could tell even before he went in where he was headed, that his stances on public lands had been an issue in his reelection campaigns. There was no question of what was going to happen here. And yet, to their shame, even some Democrats were rather light in their touch with Ryan Zinke. The fact of the matter is, Ryan Zinke is somebody who should never have been allowed into the position he's in, much like Rick Perry over at the Department of Energy. Ryan Zinke is somebody who will use his position to make it dramatically easier for corporate interests to advance privatization agendas, for corporate interests to get their hands on parts of the federal government, parts of federal property that they really shouldn't be anywhere near. Not merely because you might want to make sure that which the taxpayers have paid for or that which the taxpayers own ought to be protected, but beyond that, with people like Zinke, again, over at Energy, I think there's very little question with Rick Perry and a number of these other folks. They literally want to exploit these public properties or these public responsibilities in ways that are very destructive.
So here's where the grifters comes in that you said.
Yeah.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and author John Nichols about his latest book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. It's about the foxes that Trump has put into the henhouse of the American government. Now, Paul Ryan, you know, he's seen as part of the party establishment, and yet he's been on a mission to privatize Social Security, voucherize Medicare, get rid of Medicaid, a mission, by the way, that he's even shared with some of the leading lights of the Democratic Party, including Bill Clinton and even, you know, in some ways, Barack Obama, who made moves in that direction until he saw that he couldn't do that. So I wonder if you could address Ryan within the context of the Trumpocalypse.
Sure. I mean, there would be no Trumpocalypse. Or if we imagine the Trumpocalypse as the play out of these appointments, there would be no trajectory toward a Trumpocalypse if it wasn't for Paul Ryan. Donald Trump would not be president of the United States if Paul Ryan had chosen to stand in opposition to the rise of Donald Trump. But Paul Ryan didn't do that. Paul Ryan is a political careerist. He has hung around Washington, D.C. For more than a quarter century. He lives and breathes Washington insider power. And his power extends from the Republican Party. He is its former vice presidential candidate, its most successful congressional figure over many years, and the person who really controls a lot of the purse strings for the party, a huge fundraiser, not merely for his own campaigns, but for many, many other campaigns. Early on, he had to make a decision. Was he going to vouch for and vet Donald Trump at every turn, or was he going to stand against Trump? Was he going to say, no, this guy can't be the Republican nominee for president of the United States? He chose to vouch for Trump. There has never been an instance where Paul Ryan stood up to Donald Trump and said, this man shouldn't be president, or to go to another step to say, as president, he should not be allowed to have carte blanche. At every turn, what happens with Paul Ryan is he criticizes Donald Trump, does it quite often, and is actually quite impassioned about it at times, sometimes very strong. But during the campaign, what he always came back to was, well, of course, if he's a Republican nominee, I'll back him. Or, of course, he's better than Hillary Clinton. Or, of course, you know, party loyalty requires me to do this. And so what Paul Ryan did, and what he continues to do, is say to mainstream Republicans, even relatively moderate Republicans, as well as the press and the rest of the American people, that while he may have personal objections to Donald Trump on this issue or that, Donald Trump fits wholly within the circle of the modern Republican Party. And so, again, I go back to this core point. No one has facilitated Donald Trump's rise, and no one continues to facilitate his performance in office so thoroughly as does Paul Ryan. He legitimizes Trump. He always has. And in many cases, if you imagine Trump to be an irresponsible and out-of-control figure, where at the same time we understand Ryan to be supposedly responsible, certainly very controlled figure, then what we have to say is that Paul Ryan is, in many, many senses, more guilty, more of a harm than Donald Trump, because Donald Trump would not be possible without Paul Ryan.
Well, you know, this comes to a very telling question, and I think I'm jumping ahead a little bit because I do want to go back to some of these individuals. But I think a lot of people put a lot of stock or hope in the idea of Donald Trump getting impeached. And we haven't talked about Mike Pence yet, right? So I guess I would fold in a question about him here. But Mike Pence and Paul Ryan are all in the line of succession if Trump were impeached. Do you think that the whole idea of impeachment is really a distraction, because basically we're going to end up with people who are more accepted by the public and by the media as being normal, you know, great, huge sigh of relief, you know, than in place of Donald Trump, and that we would actually be no better off and possibly even worse off?
Well, that's a very good question, and I've gotten it. You know, I've been all over the country for this book, a wonderful tour that's taken me to New York and Washington and L.A. and San Francisco and Seattle and lots of places between. And I've gotten that question every place. Here's what I say. The power of impeachment is a glorious power. It is a wonderful power created by the founders of the American experiment. In one of their good moments, they made a lot of mistakes. They gave us the Electoral College, for instance. They gave us at least a permission for human bondage in the initial Constitution, or at least an acceptance of it. I mean, there's a lot of flaws in the founding moment. But impeachment wasn't one of them. Impeachment's a really good thing. It gives the Congress, the legislative branch, the power to hold a president to account. And impeachment's not a legal power. It's a political power, i.e., you can do it because you think the person who is in office is doing harm to the country. You don't have to prove, you know, some bill of particulars. What you have to just simply argue is this person remaining in office is damaging. It's a severe threat to the country. I think Donald Trump does pose a severe threat. I don't have a problem with proposing to impeach him. And if Donald Trump is impeached, if he were to be removed from office, it is true that in the current trajectory, Mike Pence would move to the presidency. Mike Pence is as conservative as Donald Trump, not more conservative, because I think it's very important to recognize Donald Trump, if you look at the people he's empowered, they're the extreme right. Frankly, you know, way to the right of where any Republican president has been before. So that distinction is not a particularly significant one. Pence is maybe as right-wing as Trump. he is a little bit more moderate in some of his behaviors. But also one final thing. He's an incredibly unappealing figure politically. He's lost elections. He's backed out of election campaigns because he didn't have a chance. He took the vice presidency with Donald Trump because he was fearful about winning re-election as governor of Indiana in 2016. And so the replacement of Trump with Pence in an impeachment scenario would be on balance to the good of the country. Trump would be gone, and his erratic, I think in many cases dangerous approaches would be gone. Pence would be there, but there's no way that Pence becomes a particularly appealing or well-liked president. In fact, he's closely tied to much of Trump's wrongdoing. And so at the end of the day, I think that, you know, he would serve out the term as a very weak, you know, kind of placeholder president rather than some great dynamic leader. I think that change would be to the good, so I'm sympathetic to impeachment. By the same token, when we speak of impeachment, you realize, of course, that we're looking at a Republican Congress that has, by and large, not in every case, but by and large, rubber-stamped Donald Trump. So that's not, impeachment's not coming, you know, next week or next month.
John Nichols. Stay tuned for more about his book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Nation Magazine's national affairs writer John Nichols about his latest book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. It's about the rogues gallery of alt-right hate mongers, ideological extremists, and crony capitalists that are now in charge of our government. So you talk about dangerous, and we are now in a situation where, you know, the threat of thermonuclear war is frankly far more real than it has been since 1962 in the October Missile Crisis. And I remember that crisis very, very well. I was a school kid, and I was looking at the skies every day, just thinking, is this going to be my last minute on Earth? So this is terrifying. So let's talk a little bit about the people that Trump has put in charge of U.S. foreign policy and military policy in particular. James Mad Dog Mattis and McMaster.
Well, that is a terrific place to go. And you know, I'm surprised in talking about this book how many people tend to focus so much on the domestic players, because Trump, you know, by and large, focuses on domestic messaging. When he talks about international affairs, it's only bombast. It's so simplistic. And so I am powerfully struck by how little coverage, how little discussion there is of the transformative impact that the Trump presidency is having on our military and foreign policy trajectories as a country. The best way to explain what's going on is to note that over at the Department of State, Rex Tillerson, the former oil man, who was manifestly unprepared for the position, has been systematically dialing down the power of the State Department, making it a weaker entity. He's not filling ambassadorships that he should have filled long ago. He is not maintaining programs and initiatives that are vital to having a long-term focused U.S. presence in the world on major issues. He is bumbling in his diplomacy, overwhelmingly deferent to Trump, literally saying, yeah, we can get by with less money over here. I mean, he's diminishing the State Department. He's making it a weaker entity. At the same time, Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, is proposing to move tens of billions of dollars, huge amounts of money, out of domestic programs, out of foreign aid, out of State Department programs, over to the Pentagon. And so what we end up with is a situation where the Trump presidency is creating the most powerful Pentagon in modern American history. And also, it is strengthening the military-industrial complex as no presidency before has. Now, this is not to diminish what happened under George Bush or, frankly, under Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, where they took huge amounts of our domestic resources and moved them toward wars and militarism, Reagan as well. So, I mean, this has happened. I mean, I'm not naive about it. But what Trump is doing is much more significant because the dialing down of diplomacy, the dialing down of the State Department, the shift of resources over to the military-industrial complex, we really are ending up under Trump in a situation where we realize the concerns expressed by Dwight Eisenhower in his two great speeches, his farewell address, which spoke of the military-industrial complex and the threat it might pose to research to science to education to the progression of the nation if we had so much focus on the military that we lost sight of our domestic needs. And then his great earlier speech in 1953, the Cross of Iron speech, in which he said, look, when you talk about budgeting, you have to realize every, you know, battleship that you build is a school that doesn't get built. Every, you know, military endeavor that you launch is domestic programs that don't get funded. And Eisenhower, as a former general, a military man, a great hero of World War II, was warning us that you just can't go too far into these things. Now, this is where the problem comes in with Mattis and McMaster. Mattis and McMaster are often treated as the adults in the room, quote-unquote. But the fact of the matter is both of them have long careers of wanting to dramatically increase the power, the authority, the influence of the Pentagon and of the military. And so while they may not be as personally unreasonable as Donald Trump, they are in alliance with Donald Trump as he remakes America's balance, if you will, and creates an imbalance that favors the Pentagon over both the State Department. So our international footprint is one, you know, much more erring toward militarism than it is toward diplomacy, and that diminishes the domestic programs in a way that really is damaging to the overall progression of the United States. And as a result, I'll go back to that core point. Under Trump, we are realizing the tremendous threats that were outlined by Dwight Eisenhower during his presidency. And in many ways, Eisenhower is one of the heroes of my book, not because I agreed with him on everything, but because his warnings proved to be so prescient as we look at this presidency.
And not to speak of, I mean, you're talking about a record $700 billion defense budget, taking the money from schools and putting it to the military, and then doing so-called tax reform that will slice $1.5 trillion out of the budget. And I guarantee you that, none of that, those cuts will be coming from the military budget.
No, not at all. And so we end up with a terrible circumstance. And then one final component to put on this is that, you know, if you listen to Trump's speech to the United Nations, which, by the way, was largely written by Stephen Miller, another person I profile in the book and spent a lot of time talking about, very extreme figure. But Trump's saber-rattling and his rejection of diplomacy, it's not certain to lead us to war, but it certainly increases the prospect of war. And so understand the dynamic that we are in. We are weakening our domestic programs to fund the Pentagon. We are weakening diplomacy, foreign aid to fund the Pentagon. If we were horribly, tragically, to find ourselves in another war, it would be very, very hard to dial the Pentagon down, whether you elect a Democrat or a Republican, right? The next president, if you're in a war setting, as you learned from Barack Obama, Obama did dial down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we continue to be, you know, locked into a presence in those parts of the world and a hugely expensive military budget. And so this is the great danger, and really in many senses the Trumpocalypse, is that even if Donald Trump is removed from office, if the people vote him out, even if he's impeached, whatever, the imprint that he has placed on our budgeting, on the focus of the federal government, could well continue long beyond him. And that means that long after Donald Trump is headed back to some tower in New York, we might really be suffering domestically and in many other senses because of his presidency. And again, that's why I suggest that it's so important to look beyond Donald Trump, look beyond him as a person, and look at the presidency as a whole. Look at the people who have power, what their agendas are, what agendas they're actually currently implementing, and to ask ourselves whether this is what we want. It's not enough to say you don't want Donald Trump. It's not enough to say you disagree with Donald Trump or you're angry at him for some tweet or for some statement. You have to take it deeper and say, do I want what his people are making this country? And I would argue that most Americans don't, but they have to know about that and they have to think about that if we're going to be able to resist it in any kind of meaningful way.
So another pair, aside from McMaster and Mattis, that people turn to in some kind of hope of a moderating influence on Donald Trump are Ivanka and Jared. Is this wishful thinking?
Totally wishful thinking. In fact, madness. There's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that Trump and Jared Kushner are moderating influences with this administration. First off, we're now many, many months into this administration. The president has horrified the nation and the world on a regular basis. If Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump were supposedly very close to the president on a daily basis, if they were having a moderating influence, we'd see evidence of it. Now, you'll find somebody who'll say, well, it could be worse. But the fact of the matter is, if you listen to the president's Charlottesville speech, I would ask you, how could it be worse than that? I mean, the guy literally was doing a false equivalence between racists and people who oppose racism. And so, by any measure, the fantasy that Ivanka and Jared are somehow going to fix things is really rooted in the kind of one of the worst lies that we always tell about presidencies. We always try to, you know, make it a little better by saying, well, that president's wife is a little better. Maybe she's pro-choice, or maybe she's not as vitriolic, or that president's kid is better, and maybe that kid will influence, or that president's brother is better. No, the fact of the matter is that when a president is in a position of power, that president gives positions to people who run agencies, who make things happen. Jared Kushner's got a, you know, some sort of weird advisory role running around the White House. The same with Ivanka Trump. They haven't been put in charge of anything. You know, it is true. John Kennedy put his brother, Bobby Kennedy, in charge of the Department of Justice. We've put some limits on that sort of approach to governing in the ensuing years. But, you know, there's a case of, you know, somebody where you could say, yeah, can Bobby Kennedy influence the direction of this administration? Yes, he can. He's in charge of the Department of Justice. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner have influence only to the extent that the president might listen to them on a given day. And all evidence is that hours later, that president listens to somebody else. So I really strongly emphasize that that's a foolish avenue to go down.
And yet Kushner, you say, did play a role in shaping Trump's cabinet. In fact, you say...
To the bad. Yes. Now, I will argue that you can do things to the bad. But what we were talking about was whether you could influence to the good. But you're exactly right. And yes, if you reinforce the worst instincts of Donald Trump, you can make bad things happen. And you're right about Jared Kushner. I write a lot about it because Jared Kushner clearly hates Chris Christie. Chris Christie, former federal prosecutor, clearly had a role and was in the overall mix that led to prosecution of Jared Kushner's father for a tremendous amount of wrongdoing. The father went to jail. And so Jared Kushner nurtures a anger and antipathy toward Chris Christie. It's shown at many cases. There's some evidence that Chris Christie had a real chance of being vice president and that Jared Kushner worked very, very hard to minimize that. There's also a lot of evidence that in the transition period, when Chris Christie had a real role in the transition initially, that Jared Kushner worked very, very hard to diminish that. Now, there's very little evidence that Jared Kushner's done anything since they came to office that is as influential as the blocking moves that he did play out as regards Chris Christie. But I will agree with you. That is an important thing to keep in mind, because Chris Christie is somebody I disagree with on a host of issues. However, Chris Christie coming out of the Northeast Corridor with certain sensibilities as regards what government has to do, what it can do, what it should do, would have brought at least some different players into the inner circle. By marginalizing him, by ultimately pushing him to the side, and also pushing some other key players to the side, Jared Kushner briefly increased his own influence. There's no doubt of that. But much more significantly, he cast the die, if you will, for the Trump presidency. He didn't influence who got picked for a lot of other positions, but he blocked good influence, and as a result, Trump erred even more toward the extremes in filling many positions than he might have. And the only place now where I think Kushner and Ivanka Trump have some minimal role or some presence is not as core influencers, but as part of a Goldman Sachs-centered team within the White House and in some of the agencies. But it's not Jared Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump that's leading that. It's Gary Cohn, one of the former top figures in Goldman Sachs, and he is a very, very powerful figure, and he happens to maybe be a little bit strengthened by the fact that Ivanka and Jared seem to be with him on a lot of issues, but it's Cohn who's calling the shots on this neoliberal economics, on an austerity agenda, on massive giveaways to the wealthy. Jared and Ivanka are really just spectators to that.
Well, John Nichols, this has been a fascinating conversation, and your book, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. Thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice and telling us about these folks.
It's been a pleasure to be with you. I really appreciate the way that you look at these issues, and also very much appreciate the depth you bring to these discussions. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. John Nichols' book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, is out in paperback from Public Affairs. You can read Nichols' brief guide to some of those horsemen of the Trumpocalypse that he published in The Nation magazine by going to writersvoice.net. Well, it's not just Scott Pruitt's EPA that's in the pockets of powerful corporations. Just as we were producing today's show, I learned of a new report in the magazine In These Times about the influence Monsanto has exerted over the EPA almost since its inception to suppress information about the toxicity of its blockbuster chemical glyphosate, otherwise known as Roundup. So I called up journalist Valerie Brown to talk about the article she co-authored with Elizabeth Grossman. It's titled, How Monsanto Captured the EPA and Twisted Science to Keep Glyphosate on the Market. Well, Valerie Brown, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you and your co-author, Elizabeth Grossman, wrote the study, How Monsanto Captured the EPA and Twisted Science to Keep Glyphosate on the Market. First of all, tell us, what is glyphosate and how is it used?
Glyphosate is a herbicide, which means that it kills plants, and it is the active ingredient in Roundup, which is a sort of family of products that range from commercially available consumer product sprays to kill weeds in your driveway to vast fields of genetically engineered soybeans, and foresters use it to kill plants they don't want in the forest and that kind of thing. So it's the world's most widely used herbicide.
And what are the impacts of glyphosate on human health?
Well, that's a very vexed question. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, decided that it is probably a human carcinogen based on some epidemiological studies that were done, which found an association between glyphosate exposure and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So that's probably the most pressing case of a health effect that we know of. But I was just reading an article the other day where somebody had counted up the number of studies that had been done on glyphosate, I think just in the last 10 years or so, and it was like 1,500 studies, which the EPA does not look at in any great detail when it makes its decisions. And many of these studies show things like damage to genes, and there may be some endocrine disruption of some sort, which would be hormones like reproductive hormones, testosterone, and estrogen, and even maybe possibly thyroid hormone. And glyphosate is also an antimicrobial, so it looks like it affects gut bacteria in some way. So there's no consensus right now amongst regulators, the industry, and academic researchers, and the public about what those health effects are. But there is a body of work that suggests that there are some. And when glyphosate was first registered by the EPA in 1973, many of the studies made it appear that glyphosate was what they called practically non-toxic. So, that was probably incorrect.
Yeah, in fact, you say in this article that the beginning of misinformation on glyphosate is, as far back as 44 years ago. I mean, that's almost the whole history of the EPA.
Yeah, the EPA was it 1973 or 1972? But
maybe 1970, I think.
Yeah, okay. So it was quite new at the time. The EPA was new. And so it was only 4 years since its founding that glyphosate was registered. And in that period, the EPA did not have a settled protocol for the kinds of toxicological screens that they would later develop. And so it was a little fluid. They knew they wanted to test certain things. They wanted to find out if it was a carcinogen. And then they looked at reproductive issues, and they, you know, all these studies basically showed that there wasn't much of a problem. Or in the study, the way the study was interpreted was that any problems that showed up in the test animals were not related to the glyphosate exposure. That's a really popular way to minimize what was going on. Like, there's one study where I think it was rabbits had eye irritation, and they kind of wrote it off as a pre-existing problem that these rabbits had, but it wasn't due to the glyphosate. You don't have to.
Yeah, so Scott Pruitt has just become, you know, Scott Pruitt is now one of the chief foxes in the hen house. He's been put in charge of the EPA by Donald Trump. Could you talk a little bit about what you expect from him in terms of glyphosate?
I expect that he will not do anything, and that he will actively block any effort to revisit or expand the science that the EPA looks at to decide about its health effects. I think it'll just be completely stonewalled. And today, or yesterday, he did something that is probably going to have very far-reaching effects. The FreedomWorks Foundation, which is a conservative group, had been pressing for what they wanted to clear up conflicts of interest in the EPA advisory boards and panels. And so they wanted the EPA to say that it wasn't going to allow anyone on the advisory panels who had gotten a research grant from the EPA. Well, most of those grants go to academic researchers, people at universities, people at research institutes around the country. And there are some industry people that do co-author some of these, and some consultancies have gotten grants from the EPA. But the majority of that money goes to researchers who are not connected to the industry. So essentially what Pruitt did was he just sort of wiped out anybody on the panel who has received a grant from the EPA, and that's mostly the academic researchers, right? So he didn't do anything about the conflicts of interest that are presented by people with industry ties on these same panels.
So he left the industry-connected scientists on the panel, but took off the independent scientists.
Yes, and they have a rule at the EPA that they're not supposed to let anybody on those panels that has a financial conflict of interest. But in practice, I don't think they really apply that rule. And we show in our story that back when the FIFRA, which is the panel that deals with pesticides, the FIFRA panel at the time that it was looking at glyphosate had two people on it that had very strong ties to industry. One of them was with the Chemical Industry Institute of Toxicology, and the other one was a woman who had worked at one of the chemical companies before she formed her own consultancy. So, you know, back then they weren't looking at those kinds of relationships as conflicts of interest, and they're still not.
Mm. Now, I just want to ask you one last question, and maybe it has nothing to do with glyphosate, but just in the last couple of weeks, there was a report in Science, I believe it was, Science Magazine, that we are facing what's called an insecta Armageddon. That is that up to 75% of flying insects, they didn't even look at ground insects, have disappeared, even in, you know, nature reserves. So that's the place where you'd be most likely to find them. It's not likely to be any better outside them, have disappeared. And that, you know, these insects are the very basis of our entire food chain. I wonder if glyphosate might have something to do with that.
It may. I'm not sure there is a large body of science that would support that right now, but for example, we do know that glyphosate is a bactericide. It will kill bacteria. So you know, every insect in the world has bacteria in its gut, I'm sure. We know this is true with mosquitoes and ants and, you know, all kinds of insects.
And people.
Yeah, and people, yeah. And so, you know, it seems plausible that there would be effects on the microbes that live in insects just the way there are probably effects on the human microbiome. So that could be one way that they're affected. There could be, I know the monarch butterflies are really affected by glyphosate because a lot of the milkweed is killed off by, that grew in places where, that are now big fields of, you know, soybeans and corn and so on that are genetically engineered, so they just drench the whole area and it drifts to a certain extent and it kills off, you know, what the farmers think of as weeds. And so the monarchs are in really bad shape because they don't have enough of their food supply. And then, you know, that would have cascade effects because insects eat other insects. And, you know, if one batch of insects is killed, then whoever, you know, preys on those is going to starve. And, you know, there could be probably hundreds of ways that there could be effects, but I don't right offhand know of, I think this is sort of a new piece of information about the study that looked at the forest preserves in Germany and did that calculation.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice.
I would think
go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book
Valerie
excerpts.
Brown,
the Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill
Elizabeth
Way.
Grossman.
I'm your host,
Monsanto,
Francesca Rhiannon. And Twisted Science to keep glyphosate on the market. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Valerie Brown and Elizabeth Grossman's article. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.